Well, welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We meet twice weekly, Wednesday evenings from 7:30 to 8:30, and the reference library is open from 5:30 to 7:30 before that. Sundays as today, 11 a.m. to noon, and the doors open at 10:30. Wednesday is a study class, and we are currently studying the Ocean of Theosophy, and we take a portion of it each week and ask questions and have discussion, as we do at all meetings. Everything done here is on a voluntary basis of time, of service, of money, anything you can afford, given. There's a little box on the bookcase on the way out, or you could stop at the book table to talk about how to join in service. Any help is much appreciated. We are autonomous. Every penny goes to keeping the doors open to the public. So we'll start with the United Lodge Declaration. And this is the same document used by all the lodges around the world. We think there's 28 or so now. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes, and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Which proves the fact that we are studying universal ideas. And today's topic is the strengthening, what is today's day? Strengthening of imagination and will. And this is the last Sunday for February. In March, the overall topic is the mysteries of mind. And the first talk on March 1st is what and where is mind. You will see on the book table a flyer describing what will be held on March 14th, it's a Saturday, from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. right here in the lodge. It's a forum, It's about moral decisions. Who decides what is right? Are good intentions enough? It's a theosophical approach to everyday ethics. So feel free to take one on your way. We also have a poster. And you can, if you would like to take several and pass them around at a campus or wherever you might be, a coffee shop, can we put it in your window? They usually say yes. Thank you. So strengthening the imagination and the will. I'm going to talk about the imagination, and my partner will discuss will. We had a dream last night about Prometheus, and this morning quickly found out that there are pages in the Secret Doctrine regarding the myth of Prometheus and how it corresponds to theosophy. And we think, just to take it down to the bare bones, Prometheus was the god who went against the general rule of the gods and brought fire down to man. Well, we can imagine that as an actual fire. You know, now man can keep warm. Or perhaps it was something else, and we know in the evolutionary scale that when the time comes for man to be on the scene, in order to become self-conscious, he needs help. And it is said that there is always the lighting up of mind from another to him to begin higher work. So that point, that lighting of mind, is truly the beginning of imagination. And these are all spiritual powers that we're discussing today. They lay latent in potential up to that point. But upon being lit up, and we love that phrase, with fire, the mind opens and the self is seen, and with work, lots of work, the self of all will be identified with. So we have a couple of quotes today, mostly from our favorite professor and scientist, Dr. Einstein, but we're starting with Muhammad Ali. The man who has no imagination has no wings. And we thought about that. You know, he was in the spotlight at a time where desegregation and the uplifting of a particular sect of the human race was taking place, was struggling to take place. And here's a man saying, if you have no imagination, you have no wings. If you imagine you will be treated the way you've always been treated, your wish will come true. If you imagine something higher, you will eventually demand it, and the return must come. So hopefully that idea from that quote fired up a generation to imagine they could fly. And our husband also told us that part of that success of his was that he said he never imagined looking up at the fighter from the mat. He never imagined being down. So he had pictured the whole fight in his mind before he stepped in the ring. Albert Einstein would apparently agree. Imagination is more important than knowledge, for knowledge is limited to all we now know and understand, while imagination embraces the entire world and all there ever will be to know and understand. So we need to expand our consciousness in a sense. We were thinking without his contributions, would space exploration ever take place? And would we have a wonderful reference for the first fundamental in our struggling to understand it, that correspondence with space? Here's a mind who imagined space, time, speed, all of it being interconnected so that he made a formula out of it. Well, we do that every day, don't we? We wake up, we make a formula for our day, we imagine what will happen. There's some bumps along the road, but at the end of the day, we can double check and see what we need to change for the next day. So we know this is a spiritual power. We know we possess it because we can do it. We can imagine ourselves on a beach in the Bahamas right at this moment. So we know we can use it. It's how we use it, which is the source of our talk today. How do we strengthen that image-making faculty? Again, Albert Einstein, logic will get you from A to B. Imagination will take you everywhere. So it's a matter of believing, of faith, of desire, and eventually of will, which we'll hear about. It's a matter of directing that spiritual force to something higher. Imagine a peaceful world. Imagine that we are all brothers and sisters. We say it, but what does it really mean? Imagine it, that all the kingdoms of the lower kingdoms of the earth make up this form. Imagine that, and we might use it differently. Everything is connected. I thought this was a quote. It's not. So we need to reach out to the possibilities and potential of all life. Children know this instinctively. They often have imaginary friends. And other children go right along with them. It's the adults who say, no, the imaginary friend didn't do that, you did that. And the more they are told no in their use of imagination, the more they are limited. And it's not until we grow in knowledge and training and ideas can we understand that was our expression as it could be at that time. And often imagination and what we know comes from other people, those limits. Do the ideas we hold, are they really ours, or have they been spoon-fed to us for so long that they're just oatmeal, we can give them right back anytime? Or have we thought about it and imagined something wonderful? Learn from yesterday, this is Einstein. Learn from yesterday, live for today, hope for tomorrow. The important thing is not to stop questioning. Pure theosophy. Absolutely. Now, masters went through the learning process by first imagining that perfection was possible. They didn't go from unenlightened to enlightened in one step. It was lifetimes of study and sacrifice and suffering, just like we are going through. But they can't do the work for us. It is up to us to follow the path that they have shown and imagine that it's possible. and then make it happen. We'll talk about the rest of what we have in class, but to segue over, George Bernard Shaw. Imagination is the beginning of creation. You imagine what you desire. You will what you imagine. And at last, you create what you will.
This morning, in looking at the idea of strengthening the will, we're going to answer three questions. What is the will? How does it act, particularly in a human being? And how can we strengthen the will? And we might say each of those questions has a simple answer, but many ramifications. So when we say, what is the will? The simple answer is that will is the power of spirit or consciousness in action. Will is the power of spirit or consciousness in action. Well, what does that mean? Well, spirit or consciousness, like spirit or consciousness, will is hidden in essence. It's not something we can taste or touch or weigh. Its essence is hidden from us. In fact, like spirit and consciousness, we only see it. It is only manifested through a form of matter. So consciousness wells up in our mind through the instruments of our physical body. And the will also needs some kind of vehicle through which it can manifest. In that sense, it's like electricity, which is everywhere, but we only see it when it's manifested through some kind of motion. It's moving some kind of instrument or engine of some type. Like spirit or consciousness, will is colorless and devoid of any good or bad quality. So when we think of our bare consciousness of self, I am, it has no particular attributes or qualities. It is just consciousness, awareness. It doesn't have any length or depth or color or sound. And so too will is like that. It's colorless. It's neither good nor bad in its essence. Like spirit or consciousness, will is constantly present in every portion of the universe and in every kingdom of nature. Everything is alive and conscious in its own degree. And everything is manifesting in will of some degree. In fact, if we can understand the idea that the universe is embodied consciousness, we can also say that the universe is embodied will. But what we have to question is, what is that will manifesting in the universe? What is its intention? Therefore, if will is the power of spirit in action, it is a spiritual power that is colorless, everywhere present, neither good nor bad. And in the human being, then, being the spiritual power, it is the highest, it is the most powerful faculty that we have. And not only that, it is all powerful. We can use the will in every direction we want to. So it begs an interesting question. What's more powerful, our will or our power to choose how to use it? Interesting to think about it. Like spirit or consciousness, all beings are spiritual in essence and conscious. Not all beings are self-consciousness. And even those who are self-consciousness or self-conscious are not always self-consciously aware of their spiritual nature. Similarly, will is like that. We can be aware of that we're using it, and we cannot be aware of how we're using it. It can act in ways we don't understand or not consciously recognizing how we put it into action. So in all these ways, we can see how will is spirit or consciousness in action. So how does it act, especially in the human being? And once again, there's a simple answer. And the simple answer is, behind will stands desire. But what does that mean? In the ordinary life, we say that will has no moral quality. It's neither good nor bad. We can see people doing wonderful things, and we can see them doing horrible things, but it is not their will that's directing it. It is the desire that they have that directs how their will that will be used. So whether we look at the greatest saint or the greatest sinner, they're all using the same spiritual power of will, but in a different way according to their desire. In our ordinary life, will operates in the body and mind, but it is guided by desire. We have a desire to do something, and our will directs our body to do it, or our mind to do it. We have a desire to want to study, and we find ourselves focused and concentrated and absorbing things and writing things. We have a desire to get up and move out of the room, and all of our muscles and organs all respond to that desire according to their own will and direction. And sometimes things go on that are through will, in our, acting in our body, which we don't have any conscious control of. We know we want to eat and we want to survive and thrive, so we eat food, but we don't know how we're directly directing the will of our body to accomplish that. But it is will working through our consciousness, working through all the different cells and organs of our body. But it is all put into action by our desire. And we might also say another way in which this acts, behind will stands desire, is that anything that we want to achieve has to begin with a desire. It was brought out before how those that have become wise, all wise in this life, at some point had to formulate the desire. And through that formulation of desire, the will continuously directed them to the action to achieve that. So desire is a marvelous thing. It generates the will. We want to educate, we want to purify desire, but it's something in itself that must be strengthened and, of course, has been answered at another time. Now here's a point for us to consider. In ordinary life, will is not guided by man, but makes man a slave to his desire. So behind will stands desires, but for most of us, our will is not free. It is enslaved by desire. And the best way to understand that, we think, is this little question put forth by Arjuna to Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. By what, O descendant of Rishni, is man propelled to commit offenses seemingly against his will, as if constrained by some secret force? And Krishna answers, it is lust which instigates him. It is passion sprung from the quality of desire. So in our ordinary state, our will is not free. It's a slave to a desire, and it enslaves us, our desire. So our desires draw us hither and thither and causing us to commit all sorts of actions as if we were constrained by some force. And through our desire and our inability of our will to escape that, we mold ourselves a destiny which eventually we rebel up against, but we cannot escape. And maybe after many years, we finally will that understand that here's where we are. I got myself here by what I desired. This is in fact what I desired. But now I don't want it, and there's nothing I can do to get out of it. Or so we think at the time. So how can the will be strengthened? Well, like spirit or consciousness, will exists forever. And it is fully developed in ourselves. We cannot say of our consciousness that we are more conscious. We are conscious all the time. We can be more conscious of something or someone or some knowledge, but our consciousness is always a constant quality and it's always with us. There's no practice we can do that will strengthen our ability to be conscious. We're always conscious. We can practice to be more conscious of a particular thing. So will is like that. We cannot strengthen will in itself, in its essence. It's always there, it's constant. We can strengthen our power to call upon that will to accomplish a certain tasks. So in order to make the will strong, we have to remember that it is the power of spirit. And like any power or spirit, it can get diluted if we put it into too many channels. So what has more force? Water coming through a funnel or water coming through a sieve? It's the same amount of water. So the more focused, the more one-pointed, the fewer desires we have, the more will that power of will be acting in us. So when we say that somebody has a strong will, it's not that they have any stronger a will than we do, but they have a much stronger desire and only that desire, and therefore they seem to be able to use their will more effectively. So to make our will strong, we not only have to have fewer desires, but we need to have desires that are higher, more pure, and strong. Because the closer our desire gets to the will of that universal will of the universe, remember she said the universe is embodied will, the more our little desire gets in harmony with that, the greater force we'll have. So is it easier to swim against the current or with the current? So to bring our will in harmony with universal will, our desires have to be in harmony with the universe, high, pure, altruistic. But as we said, our will is enslaved by our passions. How can we free it so our will can do what it needs to do and not be encumbered by the way we're feeling our desire? Or if we want to stop smoking or we want to go on a diet, we find it easier to exert our will to do that. How can we begin to liberate our will so we can use it and it's not constrained by our desire? And there's two methods. One's outward and one's inward. The outward method is to perform every duty that comes to us. It's the magic talisman. If we perform every duty we have without thought of reward or thought of what will happen to us personally, we gradually overcome the control desire has on us and free the will. But it also can be accomplished inwardly by placing our consciousness in that self, that changeless conscious center, which Einstein refers to as having faith in our spiritual nature, and faith in ourselves as spiritual beings. Because when our consciousness is centered there, it is free, it is detached from the influence of desire, and therefore that consciousness is free to act on its own. And what is consciousness acting on its own? It is will. So we accomplish that within and without. And the final thing we want to add to tie it in with what previously said is we can strengthen our will to manifest as we control our imagination. Because if it is true that will is the most powerful, but if the imagination is not strong or properly used, it will limit the way we express our will. So we should always keep before us the highest ideals we can imagine, and that will free our will. Mr. Judge said that it takes just as much energy to achieve the highest as it does the lowest. But if our imagination is not on the possibility of achieving highest, we will not wind up there. So that is the summary then of our presentation, but we sure you have questions and comments you'd like to make. Yes?
We live in a world, civilization, where the highest ideal or our imagination is directed outward, out into space, space travel, landing on other planets, building space stations. We've always wondered, is this an expression of that yearning for an outside God or outside of us is where our salvation lies? You know, we've always felt betrayed that our consciousness has gone that way when we live in such squalor in many places and we treat each other not as brothers. So we're wondering, why are we where we are right now? And where can our imagination take us?
Why are we where we are now, and where can our imagination take us? Well, the space program, to start with the beginning of your question, I look at it like probably the opposite from your perception of it. At some point, someone imagined there was more out there than what we see every day, and they sought proof. And that's what we're told to do. Check it. Verify it. Is there life there? Is there evidence of anything that can be helpful to us? Now, granted, it turned into a political race, and that part of it was not good, which country could get there first. But in doing so, we saw a program on the Hubble telescope recently. The images it sends back are unbelievable. And using our imagination to image what we've seen, we grow to understand the universe is multidimensional. Consciousness is everywhere, because these stars wouldn't be imploding and things wouldn't be coming into being were it not. But as was said earlier, our imagination is whatever it is we're concentrating on. And we were thinking, for instance, things like blueprints for a house. Never in my life could I imagine constructing a blueprint. But the beginning of that was someone who had an idea and imagined the shape of the house. They couldn't put it into something like a blueprint, but they could describe it. College, we finish high school. Do we imagine that we are fit to go to college and take on that challenge? Perhaps we want a PhD in something. There's an evolutionary uplifting, shall we say, with each step we take because we believe we can do it and we prove to ourselves we can. Now, how to strengthen that is to practice. Like, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice. To become adept at using any of these spiritual powers, we focus them, we concentrate on them, and as was said, we use the highest ideals as our guides.
Well, whether we are speaking of the development or the exercise of will or the strengthening and development of imagination, how we're going to use it, the key is the ideas we hold to be true. And if our idea is of expanding our knowledge outward, then obviously the direction and the answer is to explore space or to explore the oceans, explore the environment around us. If our idea is that of social equality, then we have a different imagination. So in the early 60s, two great men presented us with a dream, an imagination they had. One was the image of having a man on the moon by the end of the decade, and the other was the image of I have a dream. And by the end of the same period of time, both were achieved to a certain degree. Both were representations of ideas held in the mind, the highest conceived, that generated the imagination and the will to accomplish something that they didn't think they could do prior to that. But it had to begin with an image, a dream, an imagination. Yes?
There's another reason, I think, why this desire to go into space to find out what's there, and it's a very practical one. We realize more and more that the population of Earth is growing and growing, and the space for Earth is not enough for the masses of people that there are going to be. So they're trying to find places in space where people can live.
Yes.
That's an imagination too.
And it's also a question of ignorance, our ignorance too, because we've only been doing censuses now since the mid-1800s, and we have no idea before then, in any accurate way, what was the population of the Earth, how much the Earth as a planet can obtain. We know that there are great areas of this planet which are uninhabited and uninhabitable. And we don't, and until relatively recently, we didn't keep track of the deaths caused by great famines and floods. So we assume that there are more people now on Earth than there ever was. But we don't know that as a fact. But as you're saying, in out of concern for our lack of resources, we look elsewhere. But we should ask ourselves, is it really a problem of lack of resources or a waste or a bad distribution of them or not knowing yet how to accomplish those? And if we can't answer those questions, what makes us think we'll ever find a place where we'll have enough resources for ourselves? It's sort of like taking our problems with us on vacation.
And in the Ocean of Theosophy, it describes in one of the chapters, the right amount of souls are evolving on this planet at any given time. That in the very beginning, there was an end to that stream, that this was the next evolutionary stream of souls. And although it may seem we are overrun, we didn't know the word tsunami until the past couple of decades. But we imagine they've been going on for years. It was said floods and all kinds of catastrophes that wipe out entire groups of people or civilizations. And at the same time, maybe the birth rate is going up in America. Who knows? But we are assured that the balance is always kept in check.
During the medieval times, there was a gentleman, it might have been Francis Bacon, who had this imaginary utopia that he knew could be recreated, which is why he called it the New Atlantis. And he shared this idea with others, and this idea carried through the centuries, and some of the greatest minds of Europe shared in that idea. And some people say that it was that idea that manifested eventually as the United States of America. So it's many, 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 many thousands of people participating in that matrix that was created by him centuries after he created, which we just find fascinating if that's exactly how it happened. And it seems, in a grander scale, that what we imagine and desire, you know, it can be personal, but it can be universal. Can we think of anything going on in the biggest schemes in the human race that may be a universal matrix which we're trying to bring into reality?
We would say potable water. There are literally places on the earth that do not have drinking water, that walk miles and miles to get to a river that's relatively clean, and they hope they don't die from dysentery. We're drinking bottled water. Why? So if we really truly look at the difficulties of the globe, not just locally, but globally, there will always be an equality at some point. But karmically, right now, those without can be helped by those with. So imagining one of the students had shown us a straw that someone had created that even in filthy water, it had a filter in it, you could drink from a river. It was never put into production or used. It was.
It's called Life Straw.
Okay.
And it's usable for an entire year. But I want to say the crime of what you just mentioned. Let's take America. Let's take one area of America, the West. People moved there because their allergies were not impacted by the grass and the pollen. And then they proceeded to use the potable water to create the very gardens and lawns that they moved away from, using massive amounts of water to change a desert into a New England yard. And now they have the allergies and everything else, but they've also wasted all that water. So it may be karmic for people in other places in the world, but the karma that we are making for ourselves is really terrible. By our own waste.
It's interesting, the contribution originally pointed to how a certain individual can fire up the imagination of generations of thinkers to expand their sight of the possibility, and it can result in tremendous, in one case, scientific advances and political advances, but the opposite is unfortunately true. Our highest flights of endeavor can be clipped by our imagination. If our imagination is limited to only certain possibilities, then our minds will soar no higher. So in the late 1800s, early 1900s, scientists were saying, well, we've discovered all there is. There's nothing else for us to know about the universe. Well, of course, that was before they discovered the electron, you know, and the proton. And it wasn't until a few years ago where scientists thought they knew everything about the solar system and the universe. And then we have this Hubble telescope, which expands their vision of what the universe is like and other possibilities. So the thinkers today would laugh at the conclusions of their predecessors. Well, how about 100, 200 years from now? What will those thinkers think of us? And the only difference is the nature of the ideas we hold as what is true. So that's why so much emphasis put in theosophical education for us to check, test, verify the ideas we hold, because we absorb them like sponges from authorities and from society and from books. And if we don't critically examine us, they will clip our wings, as Muhammad Ali indicated. Yes?
If we can't necessarily investigate, as you say, we can only assume and trust those who are giving us the opinion or idea and then see if it works. But what we can work on is our attitude, no matter what. We keep thinking of that story, the two men are building with heavy stones, and they're asked what they're doing, and the one says, I'm earning money doing this miserable job, and the other says, I'm building a school for children. So it's the attitude with which we approach our imagination and will.
Yes. And the other part of that attitude is not to assume that we see the whole picture. And that's the story of the six blind men examining the elephant. Well, each had in their own imagination what an elephant was, but it was limited to their idea. So our attitude has to be one of, yes, critical review, but a certain open-mindedness and willingness to learn the ideas of others and those that have gone before us. Yes?
We recall some of the older members of our family who hardly had a grammar school education used to sing a hymn called, If I Be Lifted Up, I Will Draw All Men Unto Me. Imagine our surprise when we read something like that in the Bhagavad Gita. So the philosophy in that cryptic statement, If I Be Lifted Up, proves that the simplicity of this law can be learned by the most educated and most simple way without applying high scientific terms. So what does that word, what does that phrase mean? It was a hymnal they sang, if I be lifted up, out.
If I be lifted up in my thought and my feeling and my desire, through the power of will, which is electromagnetic in nature, I will attract all things I need for the fulfillment of my desire. I will attract all forces in nature, the help of teachers, the help of companions, the help of those who agree with me. And it's a simple experiment. Take an idea that's practical, that you really want to achieve, and for the next 2-3 weeks, desire that one thing more than anything else. Of course, you need your sleep and you need to eat. But in your free time, when you're not meeting the requirements of life, keep your mind on the desire of wanting to achieve that idea. And in your free time, take your own active steps to try to achieve that idea. And be aware of everything in nature that, quote, magically comes to assist you in that. Things people say, people, things people don't say, things people do, that seems to fall in line with what needs to be achieved. It is that will of the universe falling in line because we are learning to live in harmony. Of course, the key is this, and this is where we get away from those popular books on the law of attraction. In order for this to work in a truly spiritual way, the desires have to be higher, have to be more altruistic, have to be in harmony with the universal will. If you're only thinking about achieving what you want for yourself personally, then it becomes a contest of wills. What you want personally versus what other people want, and you'll constantly come into friction and obstacles. So the key to that, of course, is making our personal desires in harmony with the higher ones. Yes?
There was a statement made about Bacon about creating a matrix.
Mm-hmm.
We always thought that we lived in a matrix. You had mentioned that the universe is conscious. We live in it, and we keep on saying this is a unity, a oneness. So there's a vibration of harmony that runs through all of this. We have heard of groups of people taking a day and thinking the highest that they can think, you know, whether they meditate or they chant or whatever, but for universal harmony. Our question is that feeding into that matrix and therefore they're gaining strength, or are they helping build like a matrix or a natural body of love and friendship and, you know, universal brotherhood?
So are you asking, is the matrix there or do we have to build
it? Well, both.
Okay.
We were going to say all of the above, because when we start this journey consciously, we begin by changing ourselves. So the first benefit comes to us. It is different from a selfish idea because it is for a higher end. And then after that, a little bit at a time, as was said, we are adding to changing and offering hope to everyone and everything within that matrix, lifting it up, as was said before. And that is felt by everyone and everything.
Do you remember that movie in the 90s where the person says, if you build it, they will come? Of course, the Field of Dreams. The idea was, if you build the field, create the matrix, the people will come. You'll attract the people who will come and watch it. But even before you could build that field in its physical representation as a matrix, literally a field, you had to have it as a dream in your own field of the mind. It had to be pre-existing in your imagination. So everything that comes into our mind, everything we act on, everything we construct, even everything we imagine, has to have previously existed somewhere. But we are now manifesting it now in the field of our lives, in our family, in our businesses, in our lodge work. But it already pre-exists somewhere in the depths of our spiritual nature. You had your hand up before.
Actually, we had our hand up. It was consistent with what was just brought up, and our thought was, you know, just as surely as those philosophically inclined through the centuries ended up manifesting Bacon's idea in the United States, hundreds of millions of people have benefited from the opportunities, the freedoms, and the education that was never known of in medieval Europe. Well, that all comes about by groups of people who participate in that matrix, see it, share it, believe in it, and contribute in their own imagination to the creation of it. And others benefit from it if it is for the benefit of others. And isn't that exactly what the mission of HPB was when she didn't come here to create the Universal Brotherhood, but really to raise the Bodhi Manas of the race and establish a nucleus that would then begin to bring the matrix more clearly into being. Mm-hmm.
So the nucleus then not only extends out, and but it also attracts to it those elements that it needs for the further expansion and growth. Yes, it works without and within. Yes.
But sometimes beginners, and we are beginners in this life anyway, overreach in their imagination. So they imagine because they meditate, because they study, because they do the work, that they have reached a certain level, and yet they gossip within their family, or they criticize others a great deal, or they're rude to people, forgetting to see that the particular is as important as the ideal. And there's a couple of quick little things to imagine about. What others do to me is their karma. How I react and feel and behave is my karma. Karma is consequences, and I create the consequences. So if we would use our imagination to realize, and our will, where we now stand and try to be nicer, kinder.
Mm-hmm. So select an ideal, whatever that is. Perhaps for one person, it's the image of a profound spiritual teacher, one of the world's saviors, or one of the expounders of their particular great religious tradition. And we imagine to ourselves, well, how would this person act in this situation? What would they do? And try to image that person within you or guiding you and infuse that experience in your nature. In that way, your actions will be more in harmony with your own ideals. Because whatever ideal we can imagine the highest human being could be, it is really just limited by our own ideas of perfection. As we evolve, become more perfect, our ideal gets greater and greater of what that is. So we continuously recheck ourselves, and as we grow, we allow the expansion of that ideal of perfectibility to become more powerful in our lives. So we did want to stop here and remind you that this Wednesday we take up the subject of karma, and starting next week we will begin our theme for the month on the Mysteries of the Mind, where the very profound question, what and where is the mind? And we hope you've benefited from our meeting. And if you would like to contribute voluntarily, all your contributions in time, service, and money are gratefully appreciated and needed. Meeting's adjourned.
Thank you. I pushed the wrong way. I fucked up.